The Guardian.
Football Weekly Extra.
Today, Looney Tunes. Club owner Rootin' Tootin' and own foot shootin' as puts boot in Chris Hooton. Gives 5-year contract to man he met in casino. After that deal, should he fold or wait for the flop? And what awaits this weekend when the new look Magpies face Liverpool? Pod ponders all that and rounds up all the rest of the weekend's biggies too, including Chelsea, Newcastle's new neighbours on the Boulevard of Broken Dreams, and their trip to Spurs, and Man United, Arsenal, ooh, and West Ham, Man City too. There's the last word on the Champions League group stages. Sid in Spain, Rafa Benitez, and sizzling neurons ahoy, Jonathan Wilson with yet more FIFA jibber jabber. All that in Football Weekly Extra. Hello, everybody. And welcome to today's show. Welcome, Sean Ingle.
Hello.
Welcome, Barry Glendenning.
Howdy.
Welcome, Pulsing Tank of Brain.
Hello.
All right. Static, flashing from your nodes.
Yes.
Yes, indeed. Indeed. All right, but you probably knew I was going to say that. Excellent. Good. Now, off we go then. So much to talk about today. Lovely to see you all here. Jonathan, of course, you're dividing your time now between Buenos Aires and Wandsworth.
And Sunderland, yeah.
It's Sunderland,
glamour
too.
Glamour all the way.
All right, excellent, excellent. Now, big game. I mentioned it there in the intro. Newcastle's clash with Liverpool. Should we start there, shall we? And, of course, the first thing to mention is poor old Chris Hooton. Why, Sean? Why?
Well, they hadn't won in 5 games, but I think a lot of it is down to Mike Ashley, who, you know, has been feeling twitchy for a while and had wanted to make a change, I think, you know, a couple of months ago, and this gave him the opportunity.
Hooton won promotion with a weaker team that went down. He's got the mid-table. He gave them one of their biggest derby wins in a long while.
Well, we had a poll on the Guardian website, which ended up being voted on by 37,000 people. Only about 1% thought that it was the right decision to make.
1%.
Huh? The thing I don't get about it is it doesn't even fit with what you assume Ashley's strategy is, which if he still wants to sell the club, then having a manager who's very cheap, I mean, I think Hughton was on the lowest salary in the Premier League,
mm-hmm.
So a manager who's very cheap, who doesn't kick up a fuss, who could just hold the fort, keep him in mid-table until a buyer turns up. So to then get rid of him and offer a 5-year contract to somebody seems...
But you're making a fundamental error there, Jonathan. You're applying logic to Mike Ashley.
Mm.
Well, he must have something. I mean, he's made so much money that there must be something going on there. I mean, clearly, it's very harsh on Chris Hughton. I think it's the wrong decision. I can see a semi-logic there in that I think certain managers are good at certain things. So there's a Manchester City director who said to me that the first thing City should have done when they got promoted under Joe Royle was sack Joe Royle, because Joe Royle had a proven track record of getting teams promoted, but also proven track record of struggling in the Premier League. And I think they are very different jobs. So there's a sort of logic that, you know, is Hughton really the man to push on? But I think, you know, a season of consolidation is exactly what Newcastle need. It's not that they were struggling. So there is a grain of logic there that somebody who ostensibly has a good record possibly is not the right man for the job.
Mm.
But in the circumstances of Newcastle, it still seems crazy.
Barry, I know you can see the positives in this decision as a Sunderland supporter.
Well, I mean, the knee-jerk reaction was that it's a horrible thing to do, and it probably was a horrible
Christmas
thing to
well.
Do. But Chris Hughton comes out of it without his reputation tarnished. He's probably better off out of there if Ashley clearly didn't like him and doesn't want him there, so, you know, why stay? He'll get another job, no problem. And
will he?
I'd imagine so, yeah.
No, I'm not sure, because I'm not sure if he's part of that kind of coterie of known Premier League names that always wash up.
He'll get a number two's job, easily
yeah,
enough.
Which is not quite the same thing, but is the deal, which is until 2016 for Alan Pardew, is that a conscious thing because of the fact that everyone's saying, well, the Magpies have been through 6 managers in less than 3 years, so they've deliberately gone out and said, yeah, but this one's here for this long?
But managers, apart from the odd exception, the average managerial stint is probably about, what, 2 years, 2.5 years?
Mm.
So Ashley's almost certain to end up having... And this is Newcastle we're talking about, where the wheels come off at least once a year, almost like clockwork in October or November, the wheels come off. So I would be absolutely flabbergasted if Alan Pardew is still Newcastle manager in 5 years.
Mm.
I'd be quite flabbergasted if he's still Newcastle manager in 1 year, to be honest.
Well, he lasted just over a year at Southampton. He lasted just under 2 years at Charlton. I mean, he did far better at Reading, did okay at West Ham.
He did all right at Southampton, though, didn't he?
Well, he did, but he had a lot of money in he had a lot of money in a good team in an average league. So I think he did par, I'd argue.
He did quite well at West Ham. I mean, he took them to seventh in the cup final.
Yeah, and then the following season,
I think this is the point with Pardew, isn't it? I mean, I remember, was it Danny Mills saying that Pardew was the best manager he'd ever played under because the training was so interesting. He changes things around. He thought there was a real structure and logic to the training, that, and it was there to kind of to encourage the players to enjoy it. But he does seem to start well at clubs, and then he falls out with people.
Well, I think the other thing with Pardew is he has this ego. He has interesting ideas, but he also is big into all his new age. Anthony Robbins style self-help books. Reading, he famously had on the dressing room things like 5% more effort equals 16% more wins over a season, stuff like that.
That's now, very catchy.
Well, it is, but it's the sort of thing that I think you either, as a player, if you buy it, you're kind of sucked into it and you think it's great. But if
I like
you don't,
that one. You don't have to be mad to work here, but it helps.
Well, that's the sort of thing, but it was actually more scientific. It was more like, if we win seven corners in a game, we'll win more games. And I think you either buy into all that new age stuff or you actually think it's a load of bollocks.
Right.
And then you think,
doesn't The Guardian have lots of buzzwords printed all around the office?
Does it's true.
Well, my editorial management and operations,
that's
a signpost.
A lot of the glass windows, just for anyone who's never had the pleasure of wandering around the Guardian's Palatial or King's Cross headquarters, a lot of the little kind of cubicle corner offices which have glass walls, the glass walls will have a giant word superimposed on there like educate or quality, another mystery of the Guardian. Producer Ben wants me to talk about Raped on the Sofa.
Yeah, he's referring, of course, to
the rather unfortunate choice of, the analogy that he used to describe.
It wasn't an analogy, it was a cinema. I mean, basically, he described a tackle that was, and he said, look at that he's raped him there. I just think anyone, call me a wishy-washy Guardian, a liberalista, but anyone that uses raped as a synonym for a tackle
is just... Call me a pedant, that's not a synonym, that's a metaphor.
To say that he raped someone...
Is that
a metaphor? It's not a metaphor.
It's not a metaphor.
Yeah, it's using a metaphor. He didn't rape him. He's using it to suggest something else. A synonym is to say something's like something.
Could it be an analogy, Jonathan?
It could be an analogy.
Yay! Sean's having more grammar problems than Stephen Ireland. I would say.
Say synonym. I mean, basically, he said
it's not a synonym.
Anyway,
we got a lot of praise for Monday's pod. I suspect we won't be getting much for today unless it picks up considerably.
It will, listeners. Listen, what I wanted to know was he's come in. What's it going to mean for the team, though? The players were quite public about the bond that they felt with Chris Hughton, who had believed in them, as Gutierrez, I think, put it, when nobody else had. So, what kind of state are they going to be in when they face Liverpool this Saturday?
Liverpool have won 7 of the last 8 against Newcastle, but which is quite interesting, including that 5-1 at St James's when Newcastle were relegated. But then, you've got Roy Hodgson's away record, which is what...
That was a different Liverpool team. That was with Xavi Alonso.
Of course it was. Yeah. It was the year they came close to winning the title. But
it's interesting, isn't it? Because Liverpool have a dreadful away record, but Newcastle have only won 2 at home. So
Liverpool, impressive against Villa. Your friend Paul Tompkins, he points out that this time last year, Fulham had exactly... And I mean exactly the same record, home and away, wins, losses, number of goals scored, etc., that Liverpool do now. So in that sense, you do get what you pay for with the appointment of Roy Hodgson. Roy Hodgson, at this time last season, had exactly the same record that he has now with Liverpool.
Are you sure that's right?
Played 16, won 6, but scored 20 goals, won 5 at home, won 1 away. Exactly the same as what Liverpool have done. But anyway, Liverpool, they had that win against Aston Villa on Monday after our last pod. Without Jamie Carragher, without Stephen Gerrard, and without, controversially from me anyway, Fernando Torres, who declined to help out the club which pays his wages and instead attended the birth of his child, not even his first child, Sean.
Why do you think that's controversial?
Well, I think I find it strange. I mean, in what is a very delicate time for the team. Okay, they won 3-0 and they were fine. But going into that match, you thought, ooh, Liverpool really are in trouble. Gerrard's out, Carragher's going to be out for X amount of games, and... You'd have thought that Torres might think, I'll get to the hospital as soon as the game's finished, but you don't actually need to be there for the birth. And I think if your employer that pays you a massive amount of money is in desperate need of your help, you might think, I'm going to be with this child for 20 years or so, and the important stuff that I do, for the child and for the wife is going to be later. Right now, it's only a bit of kind of new manny indulgence. Be there for the conception, if possible, but by all means. But I think the delivery, you're a little bit flattering yourself that you want the handing out cigars moment.
Well, two things. First of all, right, you know, he'll play 800, you know, 1,000 games. He'll probably have two kids, we assume, three kids.
Right.
So that's one thing.
The other Spanish, he'll probably have 11 or 12.
And the second thing is that there may be employment laws as well. I think maybe once your wife gets into labour, I think you're allowed to.
Oh, I think you are allowed
John
to.
John Barnes was only a pundit, and exactly. he stayed put. Stayed at his post.
Yeah.
I'm with you on this one, James. A small part of me dies when I see a cricketer flying home from the Ashes to be... you know, my father wasn't at my birth. He wasn't at the birth of either of our two
sisters. Did he not deliver
himself? And no, he
didn't. Employing his veterinary skills? No.
He did once stitch a wound in my hand. Which, oh.
But my wife was in labour 48 hours and she had all
sorts
of pain.
We had ample time to play a football game.
But she had four needles stuck in her. And I think if I'd have been not there, it would have been a dereliction of duty. Well, so what, I think that's...
How did you help? I can't imagine how you would contribute anything but more anguish to the situation.
Without going into the specifics, when there were points where there was no one else around but me and she was in incredible pain.
Right.
And, you know, that's...
You were laying odds on whether it was a boy or a girl.
Well, we knew. But I just think that's...
Or he didn't lay odds on.
Well, but incredibly.
You look at it the other way as well. I think it's a matter of personal choice. But right. I think if he wants to be there, that's his lookout. But equally, from a club's point of view, if Torres is thinking about his wife being in labour, then is he going to be fully focused on the game?
That's an interesting question.
Just if Pardew turns out to be a success at Newcastle, will we all owe Mike Ashley a big apology?
Yeah, we will.
Yeah, for that. But he owes us apologies for other stuff, so probably cancels.
Yeah. Yeah. All right then.
I think Newcastle might nick it.
What other
stuff? Do you?
I just think Liverpool is so atrocious away from home that, and I think there'll be such a determination on the part of Newcastle to say actually we've kind of come through this unscathed that I think if Liverpool score early then they could batter Newcastle. But I wouldn't surprise me Newcastle.
Do you think Liverpool are that bad away?
I mean, they were atrocious.
Spurs though, they weren't bad.
Yeah, they weren't bad at Stoke, but they weren't bad at Spurs. But I mean, they've still comfortably beaten and deservedly beaten.
All right. In the meantime, speaking of Spurs, they host Chelsea on Sunday. Interesting match. There's contrasting fortunes. Chelsea, of course, losing at Olympique Marseille. Spurs in Europe, winning their group. They went out with this 3-3 draw with 20. They're now the joint top scorers in the Champions League. When you think back, Sean, to how it all began, 3-0 down in the opening half hour against Young Boys of Bern. Who would have thought back then? Who? That they would have...
certainly not Barry, who was writing them off. But I think we should give Spurs a hell of a lot of credit. I mean, they've scored 18 goals in their six group games. Only United, when they won the treble, and Barcelona in 99-2000 have scored more. And I think they've played... You know, people said you couldn't play that way in Europe by, you know, gung-ho and going for it, and Spurs have. And I think they've been, you know, incredibly good to watch this season, both in the Premier League and in Europe, and, you know, and all kudos to them. And they, even though the bookies don't have them as favourites to beat Chelsea, I think, you know, they are favourites, and I quite fancy them.
Well, Chelsea have a very good record there in this particular fixture. Spurs, in fact, since the Premier League began, have only won 3 of the last 18 matches at home to Chelsea, and that is from a Premier League press release, which is why it only dates back that far. Doug the Head says, I'd like to hear Jonathan Wilson's opinions on the notion of tactics at Spurs, in which case you should probably write the article. You read the article you wrote about this about a week ago. Would you care to summarise it for Doug the Head?
Harry Redknapp talks a good game of being kind of bluff and I don't care for all this fancy sophistication, but he's actually, if you look at what he's done tactically this season, he's pretty astute. He might not be able to verbalise that, and I think Tottenham have gone behind quite a lot this season and come back, so possibly his great skill is not visualising how the game will pan out beforehand, but reacting to what's happening in the game. He sees what's happening, sees what's going wrong, and is able to change it, but possibly is less good at structuring that in advance.
All right. In the meantime, how much should we read into Chelsea's defeat at Olympique Marseille?
Well, you look at Chelsea's next few games, they've got United, they've got Arsenal. Yeah, they lose those three, well, then you get, say, 1 point, and then... Ancelotti, who I admire greatly, and I think he's done a fantastic job there. But you have to worry about his future.
It's plainly not his fault, though.
Of course, it isn't. Yeah. But, you know, if you've got rid of the assistant, and he wasn't really given that much support in the summer
in transfer
signs. It's an aging team. You do wonder.
I think the worrying thing in terms of this aging team, the idea is that they bring through young players and they start to play players from their academy, but there's only one player under the age of 23 has started a game for them this season. Gal Kakuta started at Villa, I think, and was taken off at half time. Now, that's...
Josh McEachran's... did he not start in the Champions League?
Sorry, in Premier League games. Okay. Premier League games. That's a worrying sign. If your senior players are becoming too senior, and you... Okay, people like John Terry, I think he's 29, isn't he? But he's an old 29. His body's been bashed up. So he's not going to last that much longer. So I think they are very worrying signs that they started to trim at the top without... I mean, whether the youth isn't good enough or whether it just isn't ready yet, we'll find out in the next 2 or 3 years. But those young players aren't going to be coming into a settled, happy environment at the moment, which is going to make it harder for them.
Yeah. Monday night, meantime, we may as well mention it now, Man United taking on Arsenal. Woof. United topping their group, despite a 1-1 draw with Valencia. Arsenal not so much, despite their win against Partizan Belgrade. How bad was Arsenal's defending? I know we keep talking about Arsenal's defending, but the Partizan goal, astonishing bit of backing off by, who is it, Scilacci?
Who's, you know, increasingly looking, you know, worse and worse almost every game. But Maitland's not going to be back till January at the earliest. Bengalo seems almost cavalier with, you know, the way he plays Song ostensibly as a defensive midfielder, but he gets licensed to go everywhere. But then in the mix zone afterwards last night, the players were talking up their chances of winning on Monday. They're very confident they can end United's unbeaten record in the Premier League.
They've only won there three times in 18 visits since the Premier
That's
League
that press
began.
Release again.
Yeah, indeed. Did I write the same stat down for two games then? Probably. Quite possibly. Sid Lowe in Spain.
Hello, James. How are you?
I'm very well. How are you?
I'm all right. Very tired. I think the last 3 or 4 weeks are catching up with me now.
Oh, okay. Now, I'm not sure how much we have to talk about today, Sid. There's the Ballon d'Or, of course, that Spanish triumvirate. And no Wesley Snyder. The Italian's a bit miffed about that, and I'm sure Wesley himself is as well. But who's going to win it, do you think?
Well, if we believe your friends at Gazzetta dello Sport, Andres Iniesta has won it, and Vicente del Bosque has won the Coach of the Year.
Yeah.
Barcelona, as you can imagine, are extremely pleased about this, and the Barcelona press is getting very, very smug indeed. The Madrid press's take on this was brilliant the other day. Photograph of Leo Messi, Xavi Hernandez and Andres Iniesta, three Barcelona players, three players bought up through the Barcelona youth system, although there's all sorts of arguments now about what quite creates, you know, what counts as youth system, because Leo Messi did play in Argentina before coming to Spain at the age of 13. And the front page of Marca, which of course doesn't want to give credit to Barcelona, said, and the Ballon d'Or is for Spain. Which was nicely done. In Barcelona, as you can imagine, all the talk is about La Masia, the youth system they came through. I must say, I don't really understand what exactly Wesley Snyder has to do for people at least to put him on the shortlist.
Mm. Yeah.
And it's an unpopular point of view in Spain, but I don't think Andres Iniesta deserves to be in the top three.
Really? Really? Yeah. You'd give it to Xavi, wouldn't you?
I'd give it to Xavi, and I'd have Wesley Snyder a very close second. You've got to ask yourself what the criteria are. If the criteria is who's been the best player in the world over the last 12 months, without any doubt at all, it's Leo Messi. If the criteria is who's achieved the most, won the most, in the sense of, you know, kind of racking things up, then without doubt it's Wesley Snyder. Who's most in the sense of the importance of what he's won and his importance in doing so, then not just this year but for the last 3 years, I think you could argue that Xavi Hernandez has been the ideologue and, if you like, the guy imposing the style on two of the best sides we've ever seen, the current Barcelona team and the Spain side.
Wow, very nicely put. Ideologue, Sean.
Well, the other thing I'd point out is that, you know, look at Messi, who I thought had a better World Cup than most people here seem to think.
So do I. I think it's complete nonsense to say that Messi had an awful World Cup.
But
I don't think he did.
That's most people here, sir.
But the fact is, though, that, you know, Messi has Xavi and he has Iniesta giving him options and passes and everything else, and he didn't get that from the Argentinian team in the World Cup.
Yeah, absolutely.
There's a temptation to say that the one person who stopped Leo Messi being as good as Diego Maradona was Diego Maradona himself, with his ranking competence as a coach.
Mm. All right, then. Good use of the letter R there.
The Ballon d'Or is just a stupid award.
What's that? The Ballon d'Or?
Yeah.
It's a FIFA Ballon d'Or now.
I don't care.
Mm. They'll probably give it to Qatari.
Do you get a vote, Jonathan?
No, I don't want to vote. I just think individual awards have no place in football.
A bit like
goals.
Think
goals. Exactly.
Excellent.
Goals, medals, trophies, bah.
It's all about the chalkboard, isn't it, for you?
Fair enough, Sid, fair enough. Have a lovely weekend. Where are you off to this weekend?
Well, I'm actually toying with this at the moment, trying to decide to go and watch. And this takes us full circle, and what a brilliant segue that is. Hmm. I may well go on Saturday afternoon to see Getafe against Villarreal.
Oh, lovely. Excellent. Well, I hope you enjoy that.
Meanwhile, Deportivo come to Madrid, and they're possibly the worst side in the entire world to watch.
Right.
They travel to Atletico Madrid, so I may go to that as well, because it could be car crash football, not least because Atletico's coach, Kike Sanchez Flores, what is it, 6 months after he won their first trophy in 14 years, he's pretty much on his way out.
My word.
Sid, I know it's sort of your job and all that, but how do you slide all this match going past Mrs. Lowe?
With very, very, very great difficulty. But you know what? Actually, it goes beyond that. It's no longer that. How do I slide it past myself? I'm getting very, very tired of it sometimes.
Oh, Sid, ooh, that'll provoke tremors in the blogosphere and the podosphere as well. Oof. Yeah, hey,
plenty more what, where he came from.
Yeah. All right, Sid. Well, having used you up, we're now going to throw you out for this week. And
thanks very much.
Yeah, do try and get some rest and all that, and be fresh and ready for us when we dial you up on Monday. Oh no, Sean Ingalls coming in with a late finger. No, it's going to wait for after that.
Sean Ingalls coming in with a late beer. What was it?
No, I was going to ask Jonathan Wilson. Does he ever get tired of going to games?
Stick around for the answer if you want, Sid. If you're curious.
When I was
working at the FT and I was doing 140 games a season, the early rounds of the Carling Cup were just hideous. And you'd have things like, I remember when Charlton beat Liverpool 3-2, I'd said I should do that game because Liverpool were wobbling at the time, and I got sent to Man City 0, Tottenham 0, when the trains weren't working on a Sunday. It took 6 hours there, 6 hours back, and I was absolutely furious. So yes, I did get bored. But now I don't go to that many games. It's very hard to get into Premier League games because the ludicrous Dataco who run the accreditation, you have to have insurance worth £3 million, which is beyond my means.
Being a freelancer, they've changed the rules.
It's very difficult, yeah.
And at the moment, you're trying to watch cricket as well, so you're operating on no sleep.
The golf was magnificent on Sunday night as well, Graham McDowell beating Tiger Woods in the playoffs.
Sid, you're probably thinking you can sign off here, yeah? we'll catch up with you on Monday.
I already
then.
Have, you didn't realise. This is a recorded message you're listening to, which I just left on the line, just in case you should come back to me at some stage.
Ah, nice one. Very prescient of you, Sid. Nice one. All right, well, have a lovely weekend.
Fantastic. Speak to you soon.
Thanks, yeah. Sid. So, now... what?
I'm just saying, I bet Jonathan's still got time to watch, you know, classic Eastern European DVDs of...
I certainly hope so, because that's
Dinamo
what we're going to be asking
Dinamo
him about
Kiev
in part 3.
In the mid-80s.
That's different. That's
when he saves that for when Rob Smythe comes around, no?
My question is coming around. Rob lives in my spare room.
Does he?
But for now, yeah, he's between flats again, so...
Wow. The house of tactics. Wow.
It's a house of old,
I'd love to
old
see how the
manager
salt
moment.
And pepper are set out on the breakfast table.
The fridge magnet.
Rob has a big thing of salt. I don't touch salt at all. So
really?
It's quite easy for salt.
Oh, okay.
See, Rob doesn't really eat food.
Does he not?
He only eats things that are yellow, which sort of limits his options.
Bananas, eggs.
Monster Munch.
Fried chicken.
Yeah.
Right. Very old milk. Some options for Rob. Good. Europe. Who went through, who didn't? Well, etc. There were four places still to be sorted out. Arsenal went through from that group. Shakhtar went through. And Roma went through. And Copenhagen went through. Well done, Copenhagen. Axe B909. Perhaps the pod can acknowledge FC Copenhagen. I keep saying Copenhagen. It's Copenhagen, of course. Not only held Barcelona, currently under... in addition to their Champions League success, they're the first Danish side to go through, yeah? They are currently undefeated and top of the table in the Danish Superliga, where they are taking a 19-point lead into winter break. My word.
Yeah, points.
Yeah, points. Anyway, Sean, you wanted to say something.
No, I was going to just very quickly on the Arsenal. Yeah. I mean, they are going to either play Schalke or Bayern Munich or Real Madrid or Barcelona. And their players last night were sort of saying, bring on Barcelona, which I thought was a little bit foolish.
Spurs look the best equipped of... all the English sides to
really
progress. I think so, yeah. I mean, their defence is a bit shaky, but so is everyone else's.
So and a team that's going to finish outside the top seven in the Premier League is the best equipped to go all the way in Europe?
Yeah.
Okay.
Best equipped...
That tweeter's head, the one who wrote that extraordinary long piece, slagging off. which people should look up. It's very, very...
I'll put a link
accurate?
To it.
I don't know. Is it accurate? It's funny, anyway.
It's kind of ironic being accused of being obsessed by someone who wrote a 1,800 word article about a tweet.
I think it was you're a repeat offender vis-a-vis Spurs and their sensibilities, I think.
Yeah, they take their football very, very seriously, and they're very easily offended.
I mean, the one thing I'd say about Spurs is Champions League qualification, they've only had one clean sheet in the last 23 games. Now, if you're going to win in the knockout stages, you want to be keeping clean sheets away from home.
Plus, they were in a rubbish group with 20, who'd lost the Steve factor, with a Werder Bremen team in free fall, and with an Inter team that have all of a sudden, poof, I mean, I think vanished. And we should talk now about Inter, actually.
The football they're playing is great to watch. It's a lot of fun to watch those games. But I think, you know, if you look at, say, United after they lost to Real Madrid for 3-2 defeat in 2000, when Alex Ferguson decided, look, we've got to tighten this up, we're conceding too many soft goals, that realisation is going to happen sooner or later. Now, this season, it's still fun, the Champions League, and it to an extent doesn't really matter. And Spurs have players who I guess, you know, people in the rest of Europe aren't necessarily so aware of as they will be in the future. But if Spurs are to get in the Champions League on a regular basis, there will have to be, at some stage, a tightening up if actually start progressing.
All right. Now, Inter, of course, lost last night at Werder Bremen. This was interesting. Inter got beaten at the weekend, and this game, they were already qualified, but they didn't know if they were going to top the group. So the president, Massimo Moratti, amongst other things, saying that had this been 10 years ago, he would have fired Benitez by now, but he's learned that it's not always best to follow your gut instincts, he said, which is another significant thing. He said, but I want to make sure that we don't have any embarrassing scenes or shameful results in this game at Werder Bremen. So they went to Werder Bremen, they lost 3-0. And he said afterwards, I feel betrayed by this result. And they asked Benitez about this. And he said, Benitez says this game doesn't matter. The other games are important, and the World Club Championship Series in Bolton, which they're off in Abu Dhabi doing now. But Moratti has been again asked about how he feels about Benitez, and is this really something he wants to continue with? And significantly, he said, I don't want to cause any problems for the team before or during the World Clubs Cup. And after the World Cup, they asked, he said, well, we'll see. And I don't think there's any doubt that it's all over. All over, Sean.
Well, didn't the Gazetta's front page today say the world is not enough?
The world is James not enough, Bond, yeah. If you'd like to see that front page in all its pink glory, then I will be holding it aloft shortly for the benefit of internet viewers. What? Yeah, that pink thing, I'll be holding it aloft. Barry's dissolved in a fit of giggles. But yeah, it's all gone very, very wrong. It's rare. Can you think of another team that's done what Inter did and collapsed so spectacularly, so quickly? A triple winners last year, champions of Europe, and now they can't do anything.
But I mean, I've got a certain...
I know it's not Benitez's fault. Because yeah, I know it's not.
These things are to an extent cyclical, I think. To pick yourself up after a season of such success is very difficult. I think Mourinho leaving is a big issue because he, I think, emotionally, he exhausts players. I mean, look at Chelsea after he went and what happened to them. And also look at Bayern Munich this season. I mean, they're having an awful season.
Well, Chelsea, after he went, did make it, I think, all the way through to the... that was the next season. No, sorry. They did make it all the way through to the Champions League final, something I really struggle to see Inter doing. I don't think it's Benitez's fault. I think he was entirely the wrong manager, and it's easy to see this now. But Moratti himself has recognised this, and he said it needs character. He needs to give the team character, and that's clearly not something that's necessarily in Benitez's bag of managerial tricks. One thing, actually, a stat that's kind of indicative of this. If you think of Inter last season, you think of them as a really mean-spirited, nasty, vicious bunch of tacklers, yeah? They are now the team under Benitez who tackle less, or least, and get the fewest cards in all of Serie A. Werder Bremen last night, they only had 9 fouls. Producer Ben wants to know, Jonathan, are fouls overrated?
I think it's an odd way to
evaluate a
team. Because if you have the ball a lot, you don't commit many fouls. It's as easy as that.
That's true. That's true.
If you tackle well, you don't commit fouls.
Also,
so to criticise a team for not committing fouls seems a slightly odd thing to do.
Yeah, but you know what they mean.
Well, I mean, it can be indicative of a lack of fight, I guess. But
all right.
I think it's a stat to be taken in context.
Indeed. Less fun, though, that way. I find. On to the rest of the weekend in the Premier League. Aston Villa are taking on West Brom. Aston Villa were abject on Monday night at Liverpool. And again, am I seeing an end game there for Houllier already?
Well, you could be. The results certainly aren't going their way. And they were, as you say, abject against Liverpool, their performance against Blackburn, who are no particularly great shakes, was equally abject, if not worse. And Houllier put his foot in it after the game. He said that if we're going to get beaten 3-0, I'm glad it was Liverpool that beat us, which he claims it was meant to be a joke, but obviously football fans take everything far too seriously and got very upset. So and he hasn't got the support of Randy Lerner's right-hand man. He wasn't too impressed either. So, yeah, it could be the beginning of the end, certainly.
Right. Big derby game. That West Brom haven't won it for years, I think, I'm right in saying it, at Villa Park.
But the strange thing with Villa is I'd sort of gotten to my head, I think, when watching them playing Arsenal, oh, they're playing all these young kids because they've got lots of injuries and suspensions, lots of people not available. But on Monday night, I was trying to work out who wasn't there. Well, Heskey wasn't there. Petrov wasn't there. But Rio Coca wasn't there.
Ashley Young was suspended.
But I mean, yeah, I mean,
apart from that, what are the rumours have we done for?
But yeah, would you include Rio Coca in one of the kind of real key players for the side? I don't know. I mean, maybe I'm missing somebody, but there's nobody kind of.
Well, they sold off a lot of the players.
You look at that squad and you think it's not the greatest squad. If they get on the, if the momentum's against them, I find it hard to see how they can arrest it.
Well, they're very, very close to the. I don't have the league table in front of me. Two points is it from the. From the draw, Everton, another team right down there at the wrong end of things.
I really don't get Everton because they battered Sunderland in the 2-2 draw. Mm. I mean, they really should have won that game quite comfortably.
Right, they're facing Wigan, so they might see some points.
They might. I can't fathom how. I mean, I don't know how they lost 4-1 at home to West Brom. I know they had a man sent off, but having seen them against Sunderland, I thought it was a totally false position in the league. They should have won that game. Should have won it probably 3 or 4-1, and yet they never seem to get results.
Your lot, Sunderland, are all the way up in seventh, heading for Europa League football, and they are visiting Fulham, who are only a goal difference away from a place in the bottom three. You guys happy about Sunderland? Jan, he's looking good, isn't he? Good purchase.
Well, I don't like this playing the three of them up front, playing Jan, Welbeck, and Bent. Mm. I think it looked the game against West Ham on Sunday. I think it looked very very crowded. Sunderland were over direct. I think. Without Mel Broncos ending the midfield, there's nobody really to hold the ball. It all got a bit frantic. So I think Bruce has got to bite the bullet and drop one of the three.
Which one would you drop?
I think you'd probably cycle around them. I mean, at the moment, you'd say Bent's coming back from injury. He's probably not absolutely in top form. Mm. And Jan Welbeck have looked very dangerous. So I guess that's what you do. It's very difficult to say drop Bent because he's obviously been brilliant. And he was the North East Sports Writer's Sports Personality of the Year for 2010, which he fully deserves. But at the moment, I think you'd say stick with the other two because they're playing so well together.
Mm. Hughes has only won 2 out of 16 Premier League games. There hasn't been much pressure on him.
Mm.
But that's not, you know.
No. As I say, they're only goal difference away from the drop. Stoke are taking on Blackpool. Bolton host Blackburn. Wolves have Birmingham. Sean Ingle.
I'm just saying the Bolton-Blackburn is interesting in the one sense is that Blackburn have a fantastic recent record against Bolton. You know, they've won 3 and drawn 2 of the last 5, I think, at the Reebok. They did the double over them last season. You wouldn't imagine that would continue the way Bolton are playing under Owen Cole. But it's quite an interesting stat that over in that local derby, you know, Blackburn have had the wood over Bolton in recent years.
Right, okay. And one of our listeners wants to organise a Christmas special with Mrs. Kevin Davies or something like that.
I think really? She's
in a pod sense. Obviously.
I don't think she's that kind of.
No, I would hope not. But I mean, yeah. Anyway, all right. Well,
sure we could.
Yeah, see if she I'm could. Sure they'll be delighted to, you know, drop their busy Premier League life.
Mr. and Mrs. Kevin Davies run a charity in Bolton called Kids. And I'll put a link to the website, but you can buy lots of memorabilia and signed Greta Steinson sweatbands and jock straps and that kind of thing. It's a great stocking filler.
That should score some points. Barry, way to go. Excellent. Now, West Ham, Man City. That does look like a game. Doesn't it? It would be Carlos Tevez's return to his old club, only he's suspended. And what's that stat, Jonathan? When was the last time Man City won a game without Carlos Tevez featuring?
I'm afraid
January or something.
About 3 weeks ago, I can't remember.
It's about January.
Yeah, I mean, they clearly are a lot better with him in the team because he links the midfield and attacking units in a way that I don't think anybody else in the squad can. But I mean, City can go level at the top, can't they, if they win that? Because that game's on the Saturday, nobody else is playing until Sunday and the Monday.
Will they win that?
Yeah, I think probably. I mean, I don't know, City are up and down, West Ham are up and down, mainly down, but before the Sunderland game they'd won, they'd played very well in 2 games and won them. They were maybe...
Yeah, last visit to London, they actually absolutely rocked, didn't they?
Oh, City did against Fulham, they're very good in that game. But I think without Tevez at all, I still think they should have enough to win it.
You have to take into account just how bad Fulham were, though, in that game. They were really awful.
A couple of quick posts. John Bodkin Adams says, where's the Orient match report, eh? 8-2, 8-8 in brackets, spelled out 2, and we were 2-0 down. Has any team ever come from 2-0 down with 8 unanswered goals, 4 sendings off, Drosden manager sent to the stands, 1,345 brave, brave souls standing in the Arctic conditions watching one of the all-time ever epic football matches ever? Bring on Norwich, says John Bodkin Adams. Barry.
Well, I think he's pretty much said it all, hasn't he? But to answer his question, the report is here in my left hand.
All right, okay.
And he's covered it
from
all.
2-0 down to 8-2.
Yeah, and 6 of the goals came in extra time. And it finished 9 aside.
Jimmy Mack says, well done anyway to Leighton Orient. I think we need a football WikiLeaks. Good idea. You list some potential questions. What did Terry actually do with Bridges X? What actually went on in South Africa? What does Wenger really think of Ferguson? It's a very good idea. There's so many interesting ideas posted. From the negative aspects of Milkman to signing up for the Viva World Cup in a record-breaking couple of days on the Football Weekly message boards. 704 messages last time I looked. I like the Viva World Cup ones. The people are talking about seceding from FIFA and signing up for that under various different names. Super Bibbones Argy says, is this not the perfect opportunity for football to finally put two fingers up to FIFA's decision makers by making up their own World Cup tournament outside of FIFA controls? We can finally have all the rule changes every manager pundit seems to want. Goal line video technology. Check. A stop clock system like American sports to get rid of ridiculous stoppage time decisions. Check. Bring back the old offside rule, as he puts it, if they're not interfering with play, what are they doing on the pitch? Get rid of yellow cards for taking off your shirt, etc., etc., etc. Oh, if Cameroon really want to, let them wear a one piece. It's Cameroon, not Cameron. That would be... Yeah. And any other things you would like, everyone would want to join. They probably would, actually. It's a great idea, Super Pippo. Get that set up.
FIFA... I know they're not answerable to anyone, but who are they supposed to be answerable to?
I guess probably the Swiss courts, because their headquarters is in Switzerland.
Right, Swiss courts then.
But there's, I have to say, I don't really understand it, but for a long time it wasn't illegal in the Swiss law to offer bribes, which seems extraordinary to me.
Mm. Astonishing. Anyway, we're in part 3 now, aren't we? Don't know quite how that happened, but we're talking about FIFA. And, of course, Jonathan, you weren't with us on Monday. We had a long and extensive discussion. Many thanks for your kind comments, everyone, about that. It is a topic that goes on and on, and there's been yet more this week. So, if people aren't bored of the topic, I actually wanted to ask Jonathan a couple of things about, with his knowledge especially of Russia, about what the reaction's been like there and what kind of World Cup do you think it's going to be? Do you see it as a positive decision?
I mean, World Cups are the corporate nonsense as wherever they are. It doesn't really matter. I mean, once you're inside the stadiums and everything, it all looks the same. It all feels the same. It doesn't matter where in the world you are. World Cups have lost their individuality, their uniqueness, which is very sad. I think you, in respect of the decision of giving it to Russia, you've got to understand that FIFA, irrespective of all the corruption and politicking, whatever, the FIFA likes to leave a legacy. And so the week before the vote, I was asked by a Russian newspaper, so England's got great stadiums, it's got loads of fans, it's got a great league, you don't need a World Cup, why do you want it? And so it takes you back that it's an extraordinary idea that being able to host a World Cup is actually a reason why you shouldn't host a World Cup. But that actually is how it is. And so, Russia, I guess, it has, Luzhniki's a great stadium, Zenit are going to get open a new stadium next year, but they need investment elsewhere in the regions. This will provide it.
Will it be a nice World Cup to visit, do you think?
Yeah, why not?
All right. No, I'm asking. I mean, travelled extensively in Russia, so
not huge. I mean, I've been to Moscow quite a lot. I've been to St. Petersburg quite a lot. I haven't really been anywhere else. We're quite looking forward to going to other places. I mean, the problem is the distances. But that was a problem in South Africa. It'll be a problem in Brazil. And the advantage Russia has over both of those is it at least has a rail network.
Right.
And apparently fans and journalists will get free rail travel. Now, the host cities have been arranged into 4 regional clusters to try and cut down on the travelling. Apparently FIFA, as of 2014, will go back to the old system where a group will be held in 2 cities rather than, say, England playing in Rustenburg and then in Cape Town and Port Elizabeth. You play in 2 cities next to each other in the way it always used to be. So that should help to an extent. But, I mean, even within the clusters, to go from, say, Kazan to Saransk is 9 hours by train. But, you know, that for fans, that might be quite nice. 9-hour overnight train journey, you don't have to pay for a hotel that night. Take a bottle of vodka with you on the journey. It's quite a laugh.
Hmm. All right. Blatter certainly backing up that legacy business. He says that my philosophy to drive forward the expansion of football, the next regions that we need to conquer would be China and India. China very much favourites for the 2026. Well,
they were favourites 2026, but I'm not sure how they could justify going Qatar, China.
Maybe they'll do India and then do China.
But India's also under the Asian Confederation, so that creates a problem for 2026, especially given it's widely believed in Argentina, I don't know with what level of credence, that they will... Argentina and Uruguay will co-host 2030 because of the Centenary World Cup.
Oh.
Now, Uruguay clearly isn't big enough to host a tournament on its own anymore.
No, absolutely. Qatar?
Yeah, but big enough in terms of wealth. But I think that's a fair point in terms of size of country.
Oh, okay, fair enough.
Uruguay and Argentina, certainly in Argentina, it's believed they will be encouraged to co-host 2030. Which then explains, I think, possibly why Platini voted for Qatar. Because by voting for Qatar for 2022,
he stopped it going
takes
to China.
The Asian bid out of the equation for 2026 and gets it back to Europe in 2026.
Wow. Blimey. That wasn't the only thing Blatter said this week. He also said England are bad losers and there's no systematic corruption at FIFA.
Well, he's right on... Well, he's certainly right that England are bad losers and... If there's no systematic corruption, then that's great.
That's excellent news. I really sense in some reactions a bit of the arrogance of the Western world of Christian background. Interesting turn of phrase there from Sepp Blatter. Some people simply can't bear it if others get a chance for a change. What could be wrong if we start football in regions where this sport demonstrates a potential which goes far beyond sport or Qatar? No, he didn't say it like that. He said he finished at sport.
Well, I mean, it's very hard to argue with any of that, but... He's still a horrible, unctuous little Hitler, you know. So
The thing I don't grasp about Qatar, I mean, there's all of the very valid arguments about human rights and how homosexual acts are illegal there and everything. But just in practical terms, if you assume roughly 400,000, 500,000 visitors, which is what seemed to be anticipated for each World Cup, I think it was slightly fewer in South Africa, them descending on an area as small as Doha, how is that going to work? And I don't really see how that's ever going to function properly.
Well, if you're counting on most of them being in prison for the duration of the tournament, then that resolves a lot of the issue, that, as one poster was pointing out last week. I don't know. I have no idea. Were it a joint bid between the Emirates, then you could begin to at least understand that logistical problem. The other one you mentioned, though, in light of the fact that FIFA keeps trying to introduce, how can I put this, to get rid of a prejudice and repression and all that kind of thing, to go to a place where, however liberal by local standards it is, where such things are still institutional, it just seems hypocritical in the extreme.
Amen, brother.
But amen, brother.
You know, the way FIFA, if you apply for a bid, part of the thing is, you know, FIFA allowed change. You have to change the laws of the country to suit FIFA when they arrive. So FIFA could insist that, you know, for the next month, men can... go at it like hammer and tongs and everyone can be drunk in the streets.
Right. Wow, what a month it could be, Qatar. Woof.
I tell you what, England fans singing let's all have a disco congoing downtown Doha.
Tonguing each other.
They don't tend to do that.
20,000 man daisy chain.
Incidentally, if anybody from the Qatar bid wants to fly me out to Doha for the final stage of the Asian Cup, I'm very willing.
And when is that, Jonathan?
January. Just put it out there if anybody's listening who wants to pay for me.
All right. On that note, that's where we'll leave the pod for today. Many, many thanks to Jonathan Wilson for joining us.
Thank you.
And have a happy Christmas. We might see you before Christmas because you're around, aren't you, for a bit?
If selected, boss.
Oh, all right. Excellent. And Barry?
Thanks.
Thank you, Barry and Sean.
Thank you.
Thanks, Sean and producer Ben. And you, the listener, we'll be back on Monday. Have a great weekend. And if you have a chance, drop by my video review of the European papers at guardian.co.uk.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.